Welcome. This is an audio recording of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. The Council is a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to engaging the public in an exploration of global issues and foreign affairs, and we produce over 80 public events each year. To learn more about us or to become a member, visit dfwworld.org. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
We're very, very appreciative to the Cato Institute for working with us on this program. The Cato Institute has forged a partnership with the World Affairs Councils of America, and Chris and his colleagues in defense studies at the Cato Institute have or will go to over 17 World Affairs Councils or chapters around the country, and for that we're very, very grateful. Cato Institute also, I know, wants to acknowledge and thank the Plowshares Funds for the support of this initiative. How many of you are familiar with the Cato Institute? Well, looks like you could raise some money here, too. The Cato Institute is a nonprofit public policy research foundation headquartered in Washington, named for Cato's Letters, a series of libertarian pamphlets that helped lay the philosophical foundation for the American Revolution. And let me just, excuse me there, jumping on my notes. Chris comes to us with a really unique background because he served in the United States Navy and is also a very strong academic reputation, received his doctorate at Temple University, taught for a few years at St. Cloud State University, and then continued to teach back at Temple. As I mentioned, he was a commissioned officer in the U.S. Navy and is a veteran of the Gulf War. He's the author of a very interesting book, John F. Kennedy and the Missile Gap, focusing on the economic roots of national security strategy in the 50s and early 60s. You've probably seen his byline in a number of newspapers and periodicals, including the Financial Times, Washington Times, Political Science Quarterly, and the National Interest. I've seen him on TV. You probably have, too, on CNN, MSNBC, and Fox. So we are indeed very grateful that Chris came today. Some of you heard him on KERA, and that's why you're here, and I know he's got a lot more to tell us. Chris, welcome to the World Affairs Council.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you so much, Jim. Thanks to everybody at the World Affairs Council. I really want to put out a special word of thanks to Kim Rice, who has been a fine host today, shown me all around town, and very, very gracious, and also Jesse Collini, who's helped to set this up. But thanks to all of you for coming. This project, as Jim mentioned, this is kind of like the dog that catches the car. We had this vision. We published two papers last year, one in September and then another one in December, laying out the policy options to deal with Iran's nuclear program. And we took those two papers, and then we held a conference at Cato in December, and then we took the show on the road. And the plan was we reached out to the World Affairs Council National Office in D.C., and they sent out a proposal to all their chapters around the country. And we didn't know what kind of response we would get. We didn't know how many would respond, and we were prepared to kind of do as best we could. Believe it or not, there are just three of us full-time on the defense and foreign policy staff at Cato, and it has been, I think, for all my colleagues, it has been a tremendously rewarding experience, and thanks to all of you for coming out tonight. As I said, my remarks tonight and our entire approach to this are based on two papers, which I believe you have. Ted Carpenter's paper, Iran's Nuclear Program, America's Policy Options, and Justin Logan's paper that weighs the cost and benefits of preventive war. And the premise of our approach, and in fact the title of the series, is a grand bargain with Iran. And by a grand bargain, I mean simply this. A grand bargain does not apply just to Iran. A grand bargain is kind of in a general sense in negotiations when two sides have something that is very, very important to them, and they are willing to give up that one very important thing in exchange for something that's even more important. And in this case, the grand bargain is the United States drops its posture, its policy of regime change in Iran. We offer security guarantees to Iran. We normalize relations. economic and diplomatic relations, which we have not had with Iran since 1979. Those are very important things to us. But in exchange, Iran agrees to open up their nuclear program to inspections, pledges not to divert material to a weapons program, to keep it exclusively for peaceful purposes, and to abide by their obligations under the Nonproliferation Treaty. That's the grand bargain. That's the nature of it. And what I want to do over the next few minutes is lay out the other options that are available to us and try to make the case for why the other options are not the best that are available to us. We do this entire project on a very important premise. We would not do this if we thought this was an imminent, urgent threat, something that we had to deal with right away. If we thought we did not have time to weigh these difficult questions, then obviously this is not the kind of approach we would use. But we do have time. The Iranian nuclear program has been in the works for some time. In fact, it was started under the Shah. And so this has been around for some time. We do have time to deal with this. We have time to carefully and prudentially weigh the options available to us. At the same time, as I alluded to, there are no magical solutions. There are no magic bullets here. All of the options that I lay out will have some cost and some benefits, some risks, and some opportunities for us, and I want to be very honest about that. The first thing we can do to try to convince the Iranians to divest themselves of their nuclear program, it's still just a nuclear program, not a weapons program yet, not yet, is sanctions. And, of course, the United States, because we have not had trading relations with Iran since 1979, effectively we have imposed unilateral sanctions on Iran. I think it's fair to say that our unilateral sanctions have not had a very serious effect on Iran's economy. And, in fact, even multilateral sanctions of the kind that we now have, we have now imposed two rounds of multilateral sanctions under the UN. There's talk of a third probably coming out late this summer or early part of the fall. The truth is that sanctions have a very mixed track record. There are very few cases where sanctions can be pointed to as the determining factor in convincing a country to reverse course on a high priority project like a nuclear program. The one case that people cite regularly with respect to sanctions as a kind of success story is South Africa. South Africa was subjected to international sanctions and abolished the apartheid system in 1980, ultimately the downfall of the government, the apartheid government. And it's true that in the case of South Africa, sanctions were a key factor, perhaps even an instrumental factor, not the only one. But in the other instances where the United States has used sanctions, either unilaterally or in a multilateral fashion, they have not been particularly effective. And the real tragedy of sanctions, I think we've seen this in North Korea, we saw this to a certain extent with respect to Iraq, is that the regimes are powerful and autocratic and therefore are quite adept at using sanctions and kind of using the byproduct of that, the unintended consequences of that, to impoverish their citizens but not themselves. Now, there's been talk of smart sanctions. We've done things with North Korea, which have kind of hit on things that are very important to Kim Jong-il, like cognac. And there are some attempts to do that with respect to the Iranians, restricting their travel and things like that, the Iranian leaders. But the simple fact is that sanctions have a very mixed track record. I'd like to believe they would accomplish the task all by themselves. That is, again, convincing the Iranians to back away from the nuclear program. But I am quite skeptical. The second option that's available to us is what we're also doing simultaneous to the sanctions, and that is an active program by the U.S. government to subvert the clerical regime in Tehran. The Iran Freedom Support Act is the law of the land. It was passed by a wide bipartisan majority in Congress and signed into law. The policy of the U.S. government is to undermine the clerical government. We give money to reformist elements inside of Iran. There are several problems with this, and for starters, to not put too fine a point on this, we heard the same arguments with respect to Iraq. Okay, in fact, the language of the Iraq Liberation Act and the Iran Freedom Support Act are really quite striking in their similarity. At least the logic behind them is very similar. And we heard from any number of organizations and groups representing themselves as the true voice of the Iraqi people, only to learn, in the case of someone like Ayman Chalabi, that when the actual votes were counted, he received less than 0.5% of the vote. And this is not an isolated incident. The United States has experience going back through the Cold War of believing that we have found the true representatives of country X, and that they are going to be the rightful rulers if the democratic process were to take hold, only to have our hopes dashed again and again and again. In the case of Iran, it's even more troublesome because the United States was involved in the overthrow of a democratic government in 1953, the Mossadegh government. It was a coup engineered by the CIA. The United States' role in this was learned only many years after the fact. But the Iranian people know this. They remember it. If they don't remember it firsthand, they've had it drummed into their heads in every single history textbook they've read since when they were a little child. And so the problem of our past, our history with Iran, and the notion that there are anti-regime elements, there are any number of people. The young people are very dissatisfied with the clerical regime. There's dissatisfaction with the economic progress in the country. This is a sclerotic economy. This is an economy that is heavily dependent upon a single resource and yet is not equitably in any fashion sharing these resources with many Iranians. So there is a tremendous amount of hostility and opposition to the regime. The problem for the United States, as for any country that tries to do this, is once we lay our hands on these reform groups, we say, you are our rightful representatives, we believe you are the voice of the Iranian people, it immediately undermines their legitimacy inside of the country. Again, we learned this to a certain extent with respect to Iraq, but we have it firsthand from people like Shirin Ebadi, Nobel laureate, whose credentials as an anti-regime activist are impeccable. And Shirin Ebadi has said in no uncertain terms, first, that she and no other self-respecting dissident would take money from the United States, but also that in a military strike by the United States would completely destroy whatever prospects the democratic movement have in Iran today. So this is what we know about our past and about the precise nature of kind of the problem we're facing in Iran. But here's the thing. If we look at these various policy options and we focus on what we were trying to achieve, which is to eliminate the Iranian nuclear program with the presumption that it is going to be someday perhaps a weapons program, we don't want Iran to have a nuclear weapon. Consider this. Even a democratic country, several democratic countries, after all, have nuclear weapons. So just because Iran was democratic doesn't mean they wouldn't choose to go down that route. After all, as I pointed out, Iran did have a nuclear weapons program under the Shah. They're in a dangerous neighborhood. They're surrounded by nuclear-armed adversaries and folks they haven't had a particularly pleasant history with. The Russians, the Indians, the Pakistanis, the Israelis all have nuclear weapons, and the Iranians say, we need these weapons to deter, and I think it's not unreasonable to expect that even a democratic government, even what we would think of as a relatively secular, relatively liberal government, might choose to go down that road. Fair enough. The advocates of some kind of a confrontational policy with Iran say it's not that Iran would have nuclear weapons, it's that the Iranian mullahs would have their finger on a nuclear weapon, and that's a separate problem altogether. So what they're hoping for in advocating military action is to set back the program, not eliminate it, not destroy it. Even the advocates of military action don't say that they could irrevocably destroy the Iranian program. They would simply set it back some period of time, and they would set it back far enough that a democratic movement would come along and overthrow the government, and then they wouldn't be so worried about a democratic government in possession of nuclear weapons. Well, as I pointed out, these two policies, for starters, work at cross purposes because an American or a Western bombing campaign of Iran would completely eviscerate the democratic movement and set it back even farther, I contend, than the nuclear program. But the problems of military, the so-called military option, go far, far beyond that, far beyond the fact that they don't accomplish even what the advocates say it will accomplish. It's simply that the disadvantages of a military action vastly outweigh the options, the other options that are available to us, the unintended consequences, and the enormous costs and risks. I like to start by pointing out that military action is a useful euphemism. Let's be very clear here. This is war. We might think of it once upon a time as preemption, but it's not. It's preventive war. It's a different category entirely. It says that this country, we are so confident that this country will master the enrichment cycle, will weaponize that process, will then use those weapons or transfer them to terrorists. Is a whole host of steps that have to be completed before Iran will be able to be a threat to the United States or any of its neighbors. And we are so confident that's going to happen that we're going to take military action now, right now, and at the same time that we're confident that the worst case scenario is going to play out with respect to nuclear weapons if we don't take action, we are equally confident that the best case scenario will play out with respect to military action. There will be no civil war. The people we want to have take power in Tehran will take power in Tehran. They will quickly stabilize the country and therefore not require hundreds of thousands of boots on the ground as happened in Iraq or would have happened in Iraq if we had gone in with the number of troops actually necessary to stabilize the country. Let's be clear. The one thing the advocates of military action with Iran have learned from the experience in Iraq is how they do not want to repeat the experience in Iraq. They do not want the American people to believe that we're taking a military action that will result in us having to maintain a long-term occupation in the country. And they've made this case quite explicitly. They try to minimize the dangers that this could spiral out of control. And I have to say, with some pretty outrageous statements along the way, I guess one of my personal favorites is Richard Perle, who said last year, we know where these facilities are, and with 6 or 8 B-2 aircraft, they could be eliminated in a single evening. Yes, you heard that right. 6 or 8 B-2 aircraft. Perle's an interesting character, of course. He was asked by Foreign Policy magazine, 5 years from now, where do you see Iraq? And he responded, I'm reluctant to make predictions since my past predictions have not turned out very well. Well, at least he admits it there. In other contexts, I haven't seen him admit that. But, you know, a successful attack, a crippling attack against Iran's nuclear facilities would have to depend on some very, very good intelligence. And here's the thing. Our intelligence on the Iranian nuclear program is even worse than our intelligence on the Iraqi program. Yes, yes, you heard that right. Even worse. We are heavily dependent on information from dissident groups like the MEK, the Mujahideen al-Khalq, which is a terrorist organization listed as a terrorist organization by our own State Department. We are dependent upon them for information about this program in a very similar fashion to the information we received from exile groups like the Iraqi National Congress prior to the Iraq War. There are so many ironies here because the very same neoconservatives who are so critical of the CIA for its pre-Iraq war failings, they expect this same intelligence community that they are so scornful of to get it absolutely right with respect to Iran. And, you know, there's no shortage of erroneous predictions over the year. Remember what I said, that the Iranian nuclear program has proceeded in fits and starts. They have not mastered this cycle as quickly as they said they would or as the kind of worst-case scenarios played out. And there have been a raft of erroneous predictions about how quickly this would all take place. Former CIA Director Jim Woolsey predicted in 1993 that Iran would have a bomb within 8 to 10 years. Michael Ledeen warned in April 2003 that Iran would be conducting a nuclear test in the summer of 2003. Charles Krauthammer warned in January 2006 that Iran is probably just months away from the point of no return for an Iranian bomb. And needless to say, I hope such predictions do not instill a lot of confidence, at least not in my mind. But let's drill down just a bit more on the military option. Is there a military option? Is there a realistic option that we could so damage and set back this program that it would achieve our objectives and allow us to carve out at least some space to negotiate, hopefully, perhaps, with a new Iranian government down the road? Well, for starters, Richard Perle's prediction that 6 or 8 B-2 aircraft could do the thing in a single evening is a gross oversimplification. Consider just the case of the facilities at Natanz, which we know actually quite a decent amount about. Natanz, some of those facilities are buried under 18 meters of rock and concrete. The GBU-28, which is our conventional bucker buster, can penetrate approximately 6 meters. So about 12 meters to make up the difference. A lot more than I can reach. Not surprisingly, the advocates say, well, we might have to resort to tactical nuclear weapons as bunker busters. And needless to say, I hope it's extremely difficult to limit civilian casualties when you're using a penetrating, earth-penetrating nuclear weapon that kicks up tons and tons of radioactive dust and fallout. And I think this is particularly interesting with respect to the way the military has responded to talk of military strikes against Iran, particularly tactical nuclear strikes against Iran. The military leaders are quite hostile to this idea. I think part of it is because the military takes great pride in their ability to limit civilian casualties, to target things, and you simply cannot limit civilian casualties when you have these kinds of facilities buried underground or located near a lot of civilian population centers. It's interesting as well, Admiral Fallon, who's the current CENTCOM commander, head of Central Command, he essentially said earlier this year that there would not be an attack on Iran during his watch, point blank. Now, I served briefly in the Navy, as Jim mentioned. I was a ROTC and went in and out of the Straits of Hormuz exactly once, which was one time enough. Yeah, I'm a little troubled by this because we believe in the principle of civilian control. I'm a little troubled by military leaders kind of being so outspoken. On the other hand, perhaps I wish they'd been a bit more outspoken prior to the Iraq War. We now know, subsequent to all that's happened over the last 4.5 years, that they had very, very grave doubts, and they largely kept them to themselves. The other reason why the military's opinion on this matters is because the military has some grave doubts about their ability to prevail, or at least prevail with ease, in a military confrontation with Iran. Now, this might strike you as surprising. Of course, we have a $550 billion military, roughly, vastly more capable than any other military in the earth. The Iranians have essentially no navy to speak of and not much of an air force either, and so what exactly are they going to fight us with? Well, there are so many different ways the Iranians could respond. Justin, in his paper, goes into some detail. I'll betray my naval biases here, and I'll focus just on what they could do to us in the Persian Gulf. They have mines, lots and lots of mines. We had some experience with mines in the tanker war during the Iran-Iraq war. There were some floating mines that were threatening the tankers. The United States Navy went there to escort these tankers. One of those frigates, the Samuel B. Roberts, was almost cut in half by a mine. This is a very crude device, okay, a floating mine, very crude device. During the first Gulf War, we had two really state-of-the-art warships, the Princeton, which was an Aegis-class cruiser similar to the ship that I was on, put out of commission by a mine, not sunk, but put out of commission by a single mine. The Tripoli, which is a large, actually it might have been more than single, but it was put out of commission. The Tripoli, which is a marine carrier, also put out of commission. So in anticipation for this, during the second Gulf War, the Iraq War, the British and the Americans together spent a week clearing mines from the port of Umm Qasr, which is the port for Basra. 1 week, they found 11 mines. 11. The combined minesweeping capacity of the U.S. and British Navy in the Gulf took 1 week to find 11 mines, and the Iranians have 2,000, maybe more. Estimates say 2,000. They also have boats. Boats like the boat that slammed into the coal and killed, 18, 19 American sailors, parked at the harbor. If you've seen the movie Syriana, it was a rather dramatic representation of what a suicide attacker in a small boat can do. When the military ran a war game a couple years ago to kind of predict how the U.S. Navy would do in a scenario where the Iranians weren't holding anything back, they didn't do very well. They sent, I think it was 11 ships in this war game. They sent them to the bottom of the sea, at which point, it's called a Millennium Challenge, 16 U.S. Naval sent to the bottom of the sea in this war game, at which point the head of the red team, the guy who was tasked with coming up with the scenario, was accused of cheating, at which point he quit. He said, look, you gave me a job to do. I did it. I'm sorry if it didn't play out the way you thought it was going to play out. Finally, I mean, the other thing, and I probably don't have to tell a lot of you folks this, but you know, you don't need to shut down oil traffic in the Persian Gulf to dramatically raise the price of oil. You just need to raise the insurance rates. It's actually not that hard to do that. Okay, and so you know, you don't need to draw a kind of hermetically sealed line to prevent things from flowing in and out. You convince people to go elsewhere or just kind of cool their heels. you know, I think it's reasonable to make predictions at some level that the price of oil would, of course, go up. We don't know how exactly how much, if there was some kind of military action that in some fashion threatened shipping through the Straits of Hormuz. According to Cambridge Energy Research Associates, a $5 increase in oil prices would put an additional $85 million per week in Iran's coffers. So even that unintended consequence probably doesn't look all that bad from the Iranians' perspective. So the military option is what it is. It has a whole host of unintended consequences with it. But I can't help but going back to, for me, the key lesson from the Iraq War, and that is what will come after if our grandest expectations play out, if these limited military strikes ultimately result in regime change, which is what the advocates of military action really hope for. What if the Iranian people decide to overthrow their government under bombardment from the United States? What would Iran's 70 million people do then? Our strategy of creative destruction, I think of that as Schumpeter, but Michael Ledeen of AEI uses creative destruction in a very different context. He says, I mean, let's be clear here. This is our policy of regime change has led to much destruction and little creation in Iraq. So, again, who would take power in Iran? Would the deep ethnic and sectarian fissures that people point to as evidence of the weakness of the regime, would they lead to bringing down the regime, or would they lead to a civil war like we've seen in Iraq? Fair question. You know, I think the bottom line is the prospect that targeted airstrikes would not escalate, the Iranian regime would not perceive this as a threat, not just to their nuclear program, not just to their military prowess, but to their very survival, and therefore to not hold anything back. Everything at their disposal, I think that is a likely scenario. Well, as I said, none of the options are very attractive. All of them carry risks. And so if you don't take military action and they eventually master the enrichment cycle and they are eventually weaponize that through that process such that they have their hands on a nuclear device, well, we could deter them. Deter them. We deterred some pretty odious people during the Cold War, like Joseph Stalin and Chairman Mao during the height of the Cultural Revolution. So we have some experience with this. We know from the Cold War that we had some close calls. It's a risky proposition, but deterrence held, thankfully. Could we deter the Iranians? Well, it really boils down to a very simple proposition. Are they crazy? Because it turns out, a bit to our surprise, that Joseph Stalin and Chairman Mao were not crazy. And let's be very specific what I mean by crazy. Suicidal. Wishing to hasten the second coming, and them with it, and all of their citizens, and their entire country. That's what it means to be crazy when faced with an overwhelming retaliatory response by the United States, which even if we reduced our arsenal, which I'm an advocate of, dramatically, we could reduce our nuclear arsenal dramatically, we would still have a credible second strike, what's necessary for credible deterrence, well into the future. Well, as I said, I can't prove that the mullahs aren't crazy. I can't prove it. All I can base it on is how they have behaved historically in the past. And my favorite example, Justin points to a couple in his paper, my favorite example is from the Iran-Iraq War. Horrible. Horrible war. Child soldiers, the use of gas, every kind of horror you can possibly imagine. And it was an ideological struggle. This was a struggle of identity. Sunni versus Shia, Persian versus Arab. This is right after the Islamic Revolution. This was when the Iranians were holding themselves out as the vanguard of a new Islamic revolution, not just in their own country, but throughout the region, throughout the world. So this was a kind of cataclysmic struggle. In the early days, Ayatollah Khomeini swore up and down that he would never sue for peace with the Iraqis. He would demand full victory. And yet, what did he do? What did he do when faced with a catastrophic defeat or a long, interminable, inconclusive war that would bleed his country dry? What did he do? He backed down. He sued for peace. And there are other cases where Iran has been deterred. They have a chemical weapons program, they have a biological weapons program, and they have ties to terrorists. They've never as far as we know, they have never given those weapons to terrorists. Why not? Well, part of it is because they're deterred. They're concerned about how that would how other countries that have the capacity to strike them would respond to such a thing. They have not done it. As I say, I think of all the options that are available to us, the military option is the least attractive. And deterrence does carry some pretty important risks. Another thing that could happen, even if the United States was deterred from attacking Iran and they carved out for themselves a measure of security, were confident they would not be overthrown, the regime would not be overthrown, it would give them some freedom of action, even more than they already have. Look, we need to be clear. Iran is in a very, very strong position regionally, stronger than they were 5 years ago. Their bitter rival to the west is dead. Their rival to the east, the Taliban, is, well, running around all over the place, but not threatening their regime directly. They're looking around, and they're seeing that they're in a pretty advantageous position. Their proxies in Hamas is now in control of Gaza. Civil war raging in Palestine. Hezbollah remains quite strong in Lebanon. So if you were in Tehran and you survey the situation, things are looking reasonably good. And you say, well, an Iran with nuclear weapons would be even more emboldened to act even in a more aggressive and way. And this is well known. It's an understanding. It's called the security insecurity paradox, is the fancy word the political scientists put it on. It's simply, if you have a stable deterrence, a kind of parity between countries, then they are there's a certain flexibility to act below that threshold of a direct threat to the regime. And I can't rule that out. I think it's a possibility if we opt for deterrence. Another possibility, candidly, is the prospect of further proliferation in the region. It's a very serious problem. Already the Egyptians and the Saudis are making noises about developing nuclear weapons. They've, for a lot of different reasons, chosen not to do so. Some of the other Sunni Gulf states are asking about being part of a consortium or something like that. It's entirely possible. The only thing I'll say about that is there have been many, many predictions in the past about where the state of nuclear proliferation would be 10 or 15 or 20 years down the road. And every single one of those predictions have turned out wrong. The predictions have been too high. Not as many countries have chosen to develop nuclear weapons as the predictions said. And I think the reason is quite simple. For most countries, the cost and benefits of nuclear weapons, the cost of nuclear weapons simply don't match up with the benefits. They are costly. It's risky. And there are a lot of other things that most countries that have the technical wherewithal to have a nuclear weapons program, they would rather be spending their money on. So then the question really does come down to, what are the Iranians up to? Why are they developing this weapon? Well, or a program that could be a weapon. I need to be clear on that point. Well, that's what the grand bargain's all about. Because at the end of the day, the grand bargain is about testing their intentions. It's about trying to determine what is driving them. If you believe, as I do, that the main motivating factor for why they are moving down this road, why they want a nuclear program that could be weaponized in the future, is as a deterrent, to deter the United States from attacking them and overthrowing their government. They have other things to be afraid of. As I pointed out, it's not just the United States, but the grand bargain puts it on the table. It says all these other countries that are far ahead of you in terms of wealth, in terms of technical know-how, all these other countries could have the nuclear weapons program, and they haven't. Why? If we offer you the same security guarantees that other countries operate under, would you divest yourself of those weapons? And if they say no, there's two explanations. One is our pledge is incredible. They don't believe us. They wouldn't trust our security guarantee. They say it's not worth the paper it's written on. Fair point. Again, given the history, a long and ugly history between the United States and Iran, I would perfectly understand if they don't trust that. The other is they would say, no, we want that because the other is if they do trust that, then you ask, why else did you need the weapon? And the only explanation is because we intend to use it, hasten the second coming, whatever, commit mass suicide, whatever that is, and then we have our policy options rather dramatically displayed for us. Okay? The truth is, you put the grand bargain on the table, you don't take any of the other options away. All the other things we're doing still exist and are likely to move forward. Like I said, the sanctions regime, the UN sanctions are still going forward, and it does appear that there will be some agreement on a third round that kind of puts the squeeze even a little bit tighter on the Iranians. When I give this talk, I'll anticipate one of the questions. I hope there are many questions. We're going to leave time for questions, right, Jim? Okay. I will anticipate one of the questions because I've gotten it every other talk I've gotten. And it is, why do we believe they would accept a grand bargain? Why? Well, from the time when we published this paper, these papers, plural, to now, we know a little bit more about this. Not only at one point would the Iranians have accepted, note the verb tense, a grand bargain, they put one on the table. In May of 2003, right after the Mission Accomplished speech, around that time, the Iranians circulated through the Swiss. We have kind of we don't have diplomatic relations with the Iranians, so we have to go through intermediaries. They circulated a two-page document that outlines Iran's aims and U.S. aims and the steps from a negotiating process to achieve this. It's very general. It doesn't look like much. It looks like some, you know, like high school kid did it on a word processor. So, it's kind of question. How do you verify the authenticity of this? What's happened since this report first came out is members of the Bush administration who have since left the administration have attested to the fact that it was received by the Bush administration. And while it was initially dismissed as not credible, it was not ultimately confirmed as credible. And what was the American response? What was the Bush administration's response? Nothing. No response. Nothing. Now, what has happened since then? Two things. First of all, the reformists, those who are in favor of engagement with the United States in Iran, they put this on the table and their credibility was completely shot. The hardliners said, look how foolish you are. You put this offer on the table. You offered everything the Americans say they want, and they rejected. They didn't even give you the dignity of a reply. How can you possibly think we can work with these people in the future? It strengthened the hardliners enormously, undermined the credibility of the reformers. But here's the other problem. In May of 2003, the Iranians were feeling a little nervous. It's fair to say, huge American army on their border, on both sides. Let's not forget, both in Afghanistan and Iraq. And it seems that they wanted to cut a deal from a position of some nervousness, weakness. Now they're not feeling weak at all. Okay? And I think, and most people now agree, that they are much less likely to put this offer on the table. They wouldn't do it, which is why we have to do it. We have to do it. I hopefully covered the one question, but I'm sure there are many other questions you want to ask. But I hope in the course of just trying to outline these papers over the last few minutes, just to kind of restate, sanctions are attractive to a lot of people because it's a posture of confrontation. It communicates your dissatisfaction with the regime, communicates that you wish they would reverse course on policy, and we can wish and we can hope that those sanctions work, but they are hurting right now. The people they are hurting more than the regime are the people of Iran, and that is likely to continue. There is the regime change option, which I hope that Iraq has taught us a few things about. But at the end of the day, I hope that we can agree that the military option is the least attractive of all. The one thing we should not do is start another war in this region that could further destabilize it and threaten our interests for many, many years to come. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Why did the neocons have any credibility at all?
Well, the question, I'm sorry, thank you. Why do the neoconservatives have any credibility in Iraq, in Washington anymore? The one thing that they are particularly adept at is in not taking the blame and not having the blame put on them for what has happened in Iraq. They have a very simple explanation. This was a good idea. George Bush botched the execution. That's their explanation. Now, here's the thing. this is a bipartisan problem. This is not just the neoconservatives. Because the main argument you hear from Democrats, including some Democrats who voted for the war in October of 2002, is exactly the same thing. I had no idea the Bush administration was going to screw this up so badly. Look, I mean, this is what I do for a living, and I try to draw lessons from the past. I'm a historian. We try to draw lessons and use it, apply it to policy in the future. I suggest to you, if the one thing we have learned from Iraq is it was a good idea poorly executed, we haven't learned a thing. We haven't learned a thing. That's not just the neoconservatives' problem. Yes, sir. In the back. Yes, sir. Right. The question was, what about Israel's role in this? Is it possible they could take action which would essentially take things out of our hands? It's a very good question. For starters, a decision by Israel to attack Iran, even if the United States had nothing to do with it, would be the functional equivalent of the United States attacking Iran. Okay. For starters, any Israeli attack on Iran would fly through American-controlled airspace. So at some level, we'd be complicit in that. And presumably, we don't allow unidentified aircraft to traverse that airspace at will. But the question pertains to, I have made the case that our deterrent is credible and that the Iranians would not be foolish enough to attack the United States directly because they would know that it would result in their complete annihilation. The Israelis can make and have made exactly the same argument. The Israelis are right now working to develop their nuclear deterrent such that they would have a credible second strike. They're moving to some submarine-launched missiles that would allow them to retaliate even in the event of a surprise first attack. And again, you know, you talk about nuclear deterrence, it's a horrible prospect, thinking the unthinkable, all these things, and yet this is the logic. You have to lay out these scenarios in a very kind of cold and calculating way, and the Israelis have done that. There are ways to when I talk about security guarantees, and I think I alluded to this, it's not enough for the United States to pledge not to overthrow the regime in Iran and to attack them militarily. Those security guarantees extend broader than that, that we will, in concert with their neighbors, not engage in military action. It's a, you know, both ways. It is a pledge not to engage in military action. But your question is a good one. It is not true, as some have suggested, that the Israelis could somehow do this job for us and we could avoid all of the horrible worst-case scenarios that I've laid out in terms of military action. All of those things would be on the table. I guess the thing I didn't mention, which is kind of maybe it's so obvious I didn't mention it, was what the Iranians could do to American forces in Iraq. Okay, our supply lines from Kuwait to Baghdad are extremely tenuous. They go through some of the most heavily Shiite areas in Iraq. A lot of these are truck convoys driven by foreign contractors. So if you put a little bit of pressure on these supply lines, do you not think you could put enormous pressure on our people in Baghdad, our diplomatic personnel, our troops? It's a very, very dangerous prospect. So in addition, I was fixed on the Navy part of it, worried about thinking back to my days in the Straits of Hormuz. But the fact is the Iranians have many opportunities to retaliate. They could also, of course, employ terrorist attacks. Some people have called Hezbollah the A-team of terrorism, whereas al-Qaeda is kind of the farm team or the B-team of terrorism. I don't know if that's true. Some people have suggested Hezbollah has sleeper cells in the United States. I don't think we could rule out the possibility of terrorist attacks in retaliation here in the United States. The more likely scenario is that Hezbollah would retaliate against American interests elsewhere in the world, and of course we have many, many targets that they could attack. So the Iranians have many, many different ways to retaliate, and they would, I think, respond to an Israeli attack just as though it were an attack from an American aircraft carrier or from an American airbase.
Do the women in Iran have any influence on policy?
Yes. They do have influence in policy. They hold some political office. This is not Saudi Arabia. This is not even Afghanistan, frankly. They do. I mean, it's, you know, Shirin Ebadi is a famous example of this, but there are others. And so I think the challenge, again, is in trying to identify who among the reformists represents the largest segment of the population is the representatives, and truthfully, we often don't find that out until the elections are held. So, generally speaking, yes, they do have influence, but it's hard to kind of fix on who among them might be among the kind of leaders. Now, I saw another hand up. Yes, sir, go ahead. Why is it the Iranians are heavily dependent upon fuel refined elsewhere? Their refining capacity is quite limited. And so what about attacks or pressure, accidents on these refining facilities? Would that put additional pressure on the regime? It's quite striking because I read in the newspaper this morning that the Iranians, in preparation for the possibility of sanctions against the fuel sector, the gasoline sector, would impose rationing. Sure enough, they did. And within a few hours, there were riots in the streets, gasoline stations, filling stations torched, and various unhappy incidents going on all over the country. The interesting thing is Ahmadinejad was elected on a platform of economic reform, okay, of spreading the wealth and the benefits to his people around the country. He has utterly failed. The trick, however, is that he has continued to point to Western pressure and say, don't blame me for these problems. Your misery is caused by, you know, the United States or the West or these UN sanctions or whatever else. I think my own sense is he may have gone to the well too many times already on that. And that, in fact, people will see his incompetence, his incapacity for dealing with the many different problems that are available to him. But again, if it is an accident or a strike against these refining facilities, and the U.S. fingerprints are all over that, it will really deliver a setback to the democratic, the reform movement inside of Iran. They have a long and unhappy history of the United States meddling in their internal affairs, and they are trying to get out from under that reputation of being stooges of the United States. It's not fair. It's not accurate. But there is always that ability for Ahmadinejad to point the finger and say they are not acting as patriots, which is what they are, but they're acting merely at the behest of a foreign power. I wish we had a mic on that because virtually every presentation I give, there's someone like you, sir, in the audience who makes the same argument. We've heard it from many, many different quarters. What is striking, however, I have to give some attention to the other side. There is this logic, if you can call it that, that if the United States launches a military strike, that it will set forth this nascent pro-democracy, pro-American movement to overthrow the government. I'm sorry, historically, this has never worked. It never works. The people do not rise up and embrace the people that are dropping bombs on them, even if the bombs are being dropped. I mean, it never works. I it's striking to me why this argument continues to be made. There are so many different ways to undermine this regime, and they are being done by the Iranian people. They're being done by the work of folks just like you, sir, who are going there voluntarily in a non-coercive way and not at the behest of the U.S. government, but simply because you love both countries, I presume. And therefore, we have this all the time, and the challenge, this kind of segues into some of the other work that Cato does. So often when we think about foreign policy, it's about what we do, what we Americans do, and we confuse we for the government. But the truth is that most of the good work in terms of engagement, this peaceful, non-coercive engagement that Americans have with people all over the world, is not done at the behest of the U.S. government. It's done by individuals pursuing business interests or family or all these other things. And when the U.S. government gets involved, it crowds out this behavior and it undermines the legitimacy of this behavior. I mean, the great tragedy is that liberalism was ascendant and is ascendant in places where it is not associated with America's bad reputation, which has grown up over the last few years. And as a liberal in the old sense of the term, like the John Stuart Mill liberal, okay, this is tragic and it pains me. And we need to recover that. We need to recover that. And it's done by people just like you, not by the U.S. government.
Mark, what would happen if the United States or Israel were to conduct an assassination of Ahmadinejad?
Good question. It what would happen? He would, if they succeeded, he would be dead. And then what? I mean, because this is the part that people don't. And then what? Because yes, he's just one man, and not a very good one, not a very effective leader, not a very attractive world leader for a whole host of reasons. But then what happens? If the end result is a civil war, which is not inconceivable. I mean, we've learned this tragically in Iraq. Or in places like, you know, after the end of the Cold War and, you know, in Yugoslavia, then what? And are we not in some measure responsible for the chaos that ensues if that happens after the fact? So I think whether you're talking about a decapitation strike, which is the most precise kind of decapitation strike, or one that is a bit more generalized and it hits, you know, military command and control centers and anti-air facilities and the various facilities for enriching uranium and weapon, and you hope that that action also results in the removal of the regime, then what? Why is it that that would not necessitate, or at least is there not the chance, I think there is the chance, that it would require a very, very large U.S. presence on the ground, much, much larger than we can march. I mean, let's be clear about this very quickly. I don't want to leave time. Iran has not been weakened by 12 years of sanctions like Iraq was. They have not been contained in the same way that Iraq was contained. They are 2.5 times the size in terms of population. Almost the same, almost 2.5 times in terms of geography. How many troops would it take to stabilize a country the size of Iran? Well, more than we have in Iraq. I mean, I hope that goes without saying. Okay, many other questions. That's good. So please.
Right here. On the end.
Oh, sorry. You had your hand up. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jim. You're helping me out. Right? Sure. That's a terrific question. And what I think is
I'm going to have to ask you to repeat.
Sorry. The question is, while it may be true that Khomeini backed down at the time of during the Iran-Iraq war, what do we know about the current regime? Why is it that we have some confidence that they would act rationally? What is their relationship to Ahmadinejad, who, at least in terms of his rhetoric, is not acting particularly rationally? That's where it gets interesting, is the interesting, at times tense, at times conflicting relationship between Ahmadinejad and the religious leaders. There have been times when Ahmadinejad has been reined in by the religious leaders. And the moments at which he has been reined in are when he has kind of really gone overboard with his rhetoric, adopting a particularly hostile approach, a particularly confrontational posture, and he has been reined in. There is a very serious debate going on inside of Iran right now. I alluded to this when I mentioned the Iranian offer in May of 2003, but that process has continued. Just look at what we've seen over the last 6 months in U.S.-Iranian relations and how these two factions inside of Iran have competed with each other. You had the multilateral regional meeting in Baghdad with all of the neighboring states, which was immediately followed by the seizure of the 15 British sailors by the Revolutionary Guard Corps. You then had the bilateral meeting between the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, the Iranian ambassador to Iraq, and the Iraqis, immediately followed by the jailing of the 5 American-Iranian pro-democracy NGO people. That is a very dramatic representation of this tension. It suggests to me that even among the mullahs, there is a certain kind of realpolitik at play here, a sense that we cannot be sure that if one of these incidents escalates, we cannot be sure that the end result will be good for us, for the regime. And at the end of the day, when we talk about are they crazy, it's are they suicidal? I mean, yes, there are risk. You know, some people are more risky than others, more prone to risk. But I don't believe they're exhibiting that. And I think, again, the irony is that it's the Democrat, in this case, in a very loose sense of the term, the democratically elected Ahmadinejad, who perhaps is a bit less reliable in that sense than the religious leaders are. All right, those are great questions. I'm going to work backwards. Jim, to your question, the simple answer is we just don't know. There is Clearly, the Iranians have had a long-standing relationship with some of the leading Shia parties in Iraq, including Skiri and Dawa, the two leading parties. What's interesting to me and a bit troubling is that the one Shiite faction that was not prone to side with Iran is the Jaish al-Mahdi, the Mahdi army, Muqtada Sadr's group. Sadr had always held himself out as an Iraqi first, an Arab first, and had not had this long tradition of relationship with the Iranians. He has actually grown closer to the Iranians, by all indication, over the last few years. So I think it is true that the Iranians would like to see a continuation of at least a neutral and preferably a friendly government in Baghdad, and I think they are likely to get that, regardless of you know, kind of. And in terms of, you know, we just simply can't prove what they're doing in terms of the devices that are causing so many casualties among our troops there. It would not surprise me if they have a hand in it, but it's also extremely difficult to prove that directly. Who would take over? Terrific question. I tried to allude that to a little bit. The answer is we simply don't know. We simply don't know. The point is, as you did, is to point out point by point who is holding themselves out as the rightful representatives and why they do not have credibility. The Royalists do not have credibility. The MEK does not have credibility. There is a void there that is going to have to develop over time, where there are alternatives to these thoroughly discredited other factions, anti-regime elements. I can't answer the question about why we did what we did during the Iran-Iraq War. I can't answer that question for you. I'll be honest. Immediately after the first Gulf War, okay, after we drove Saddam out of Kuwait, we spent as much time looking to the west as we did to the east as we did to the west. We're operating the Persian Gulf. We had just completed a war with Iraq, and we were spending almost as much time looking in the other direction, which implies to you that there was not a lot of long-range kind of strategic thinking about what would happen if you actually succeeded in removing Saddam Hussein. The other question is even easier to answer. The Cato Institute does not take positions on policies. Cato scholars do. The good news is, in the case of, and my colleagues and I generally agree on foreign policy, my foreign policy colleagues and I generally agree on this issue, we are completely in agreement. So I am totally comfortable talking about their papers as they are my work on this. I want to go back, though, and close on this public diplomacy question. I believe, as I've tried alluded to, I believe in the power of engagement, of individuals being active in the global stage, but doing so on their own initiative. Okay? It happens all the time. We should empower this. We should celebrate this. When we put a made in the USA kind of stamp, a U.S. government stamp on public diplomacy, it immediately becomes an instrument of policy. And that's problematic because the gentleman said, and this is shown by numerous polls, the American public is popular, American policy is not. So once you put the policymaker stamp on something, it is immediately undermined, and that is tragic. I go back to what I said about people being engaged, and I close with this. I mean, you know, we're libertarians, so we joke about, you know, we're from the government, we're here to help. I guess not only libertarians joke about that, right? Here's the thing. When we talk about how the U.S. government engages with people on the other side of the world or outside of the United States, okay? If you look at just from a budgetary perspective, and you look at all the various agencies and organizations who are responsible for some kind of interaction and engagement with the rest of the world, you look at the budget, and you were to meet someone elsewhere, and they said, "I'm from the U.S. government," there's a 93% chance they're carrying a gun. Okay? Because just do the math. 93% of the external affairs budget is military, and 7% is everything else. 93% chance they're carrying a gun. If you're an American and you meet someone overseas and they meet you and they say and you say, "I'm from the United States and I'm not from the U.S. government," there's virtually 100% chance you're not carrying a gun. And this is all about this non-coercive aspect of it. Is our ideas, our ideals, the values that built this country were ascendant before our latest round of difficulty, okay? And it is a great tragedy, and it is up to Americans, not the U.S. government, Americans, to recover that spirit, to make the case for liberalism, for democracy, for tolerance, all of those things. Americans are much more likely to do it and succeed if they are not agents of the government. Now that's a word from your sponsor right there. That's what the Cato Institute thinks there. Okay?
I think that was a very important message before July 4th, don't you? Let's give another hand of applause for Chris. Thank you.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.